Hello, everybody. Warren Smith here, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of the Ministry Watch podcast. Today, we're going to talk about character in our leaders, a conversation with Dr. Marvin Olasky. In today's secular postmodern world, many Americans, even many Christians, have settled for a transactional relationship with their leaders, leaders in church, government, in our civic institutions. If those leaders give us what we want when we want it, well, that seems to be all that we ask of them. But Marvin Olasky believes that character matters when it comes to leadership. He's studied great leaders in American history from the founding era all the way to today. And he's written about them in a fascinating new book called Moral Vision: Leadership from George Washington to Joe Biden. Now, Marvin Olasky probably needs no introduction to many of you. He spent nearly 30 years as editor-in-chief at World Magazine. He served as the provost, which is the senior academic officer for the King's College in New York City. He was a tenured faculty member at the University of Texas, and he has served as a mentor to an entire generation of reporters and editors who are now making a difference in publications both here and abroad. And I should also disclose that I am one of them. Marvin has been a mentor and a friend to me for more than 25 years. I worked for him when he was editor-in-chief at World, and I helped him revise his classic book, Prodigal Press, a few years ago. In fact, the journalism that we do here at Ministry Watch is a direct result of what, over the years, I have learned from Marvin Olasky. So with that all too brief introduction, here's my conversation with Marvin Olasky. Well, Marvin, welcome to the program. And when I have an author on, it's hard to know exactly where to begin, because I don't want to, you know, go through the entire book. If people want to read the book, they can read the book, right? I mean, I don't want to give them a full vision, but on the other hand, I do want to give them a taste. I think whenever I have someone like you who's been writing for so long, and especially about these topics, I mean, you wrote The American Leadership Tradition, what, 25 years ago? Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you've been thinking about these issues for so long. I think the more relevant question that I'd like to ask right now is, why this book now? As I said, you wrote The American Leadership Tradition 25 years ago. Why did you feel that we were in a cultural moment that made sense for you to revisit these issues and these people?
Three reasons. First, I'm, I suppose, semi-retired now, and some people like playing golf and I like writing. Secondly, going back 25 years, I think that I had a little bit of reaction, maybe overreaction, to Bill Clinton, the Monica Lewinsky affair, and so forth. So some of the things that I was writing in terms of the looking at various presidents was seen through that particular lens. The original name of it, it came out as The American Leadership Tradition. The original title was God, Sex, and Statesmanship. And I paid a lot of attention to the second because of Bill Clinton, and maybe too much attention, and maybe sometimes overwrought a little bit. So this was my opportunity to fix that. And then third, right now, and I don't want to get too political, but I suppose I need to, we have a lot of craziness in American politics right now. And we have a person who seems about to be anointed as the Republican candidate again, who fails just about all the previous tests people had as far as logical thinking as a president, truth-telling as a president, all kinds of character questions. So this whole question that I was originally looking at 25 years ago in terms of the character of leaders and what difference that makes is very much on the agenda right now.
So let's just stipulate for the record that character does count. I mean, that if I could reduce your book to one sentence, First of all, I'd be foolish to do that. But if I did, that would probably be the sentence, right? I mean, character does matter. It's not just a transactional relationship that Americans have with their political leaders. In other words, if they vote right, then we should vote for them. But we should care about their character whenever we choose our leaders. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's exactly fair. And yeah, we tend to look sometimes just at voting records. Voter guides come out listing what candidates say or have said on various things. But yeah, the character question is really even more important than the voting record.
You know, there's going to be people, Marvin, who would disagree with that. You know, as long as they vote right, I really don't care about their personal lives. But I think one of the things that we're seeing, for example, with the abortion issue and maybe the Dobbs decision, is that, yeah, that transactional politics will get Roe v. Wade overturned. But it will, in some ways, it has made an abortion-free America harder, farther from reality, even though we've won some legal victories, because the folks that we need to persuade on that question have become less persuadable than ever because of the way in which some of our political leaders have gone about these political victories. So if we just pay attention to transaction achieving a particular political end, we can end up being farther away from the goal rather than closer to the goal. If the goal is really cultural change, if the goal is really changing, the way people feel and behave about the issues that we care about, is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. The comparison has been made by all of us many of us on the pro-life side. The comparison is between, say, the abolition of slavery in the 19th century. And what we would hope for would be the abolition of abortion right now. But the abortion issue is more complicated than the slavery issue, insofar as it's the unborn children are certainly human beings, but they are not on their own at this point. And so it's a little different that way. And even if you make the comparison with the slavery issue, yes, we had a civil war in which 700,000 plus people died of a population of 30 million. And it was an important war to fight. Lincoln was right about it. But for a dozen years after the Civil War, there was Reconstruction, an attempt to make sure that the North actually won the Civil War and that Black people in the South were free. 1877, that ended. And yes, Black people were legally free, but under a different type of something that was like slavery. And so that wasn't a good resolution to the whole thing. And so an abortion, again, taking the parallel as far as you can, I mean, even if you had, as we have right now, at least in the Supreme Court, we have an open opportunity to pass laws abolishing abortion. And I think those are good laws to have, but it is easy to evade those laws. And if we end up with more abortions because people are thinking, well, Donald Trump is the head of the pro-life movement and look at the type of person he is, and maybe you pro-lifers are like that, then we're not really achieving anything. The goal is not just to have a law in the books, but to have fewer abortions in America. And at least the early returns may indicate that we have more now rather than fewer.
Yeah, I've heard it said that the goal is not to make abortion illegal, but to make abortion unthinkable. And it seems like the closer we get to making it illegal, the farther we get to making it unthinkable because we've energized the resistance.
Yeah, I'm not sure we're ever going to make it unthinkable because abortion goes way back in American history, back to the 1600s, and it goes way back in human history. But certainly unthinkable in the sense of think twice or thrice or four times before going ahead with something like this and realize how horrendous this is. Just a sense in people's minds that, yes, we can think about it, but we never want to do it.
Well, I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, Marvin, especially since you've written other great books about this topic, abortion rights, for example, and your more recent book that you wrote with Leah Savas on abortion. And I commend those books to you if you want to look at those, look at that issue more closely. But I just did want to bring that issue up just to make the point that, again, the key point of this book, that that character really does matter, that these issues of leadership are more than merely transactional in nature. And you get at that question or these issues, Marvin, by looking at some of the iconic figures in American history. Most of them are presidents, but not all of them by any stretch of the imagination. So, for example, you have Ida B. Wells, Booker T. Washington, John D. Rockefeller, among the non-presidents. But you do have a lot of presidents, both Roosevelt's, Woodrow Wilson, John Kennedy, and of course, we've already talked about Trump and Biden. You've got a chapter sort of combining the two of them. Let me just ask, how did you pick these figures? What sort of a mental sieve did you place American leaders through before you came up with this particular list to make the points that you wanted to make?
Yeah, good question. Two answers to it. Number one, when it came to making the original choice back in the 1990s, I was thinking of the education I had in the late 60s and the early 70s, where there was an historian named Richard Hofstadter, who was hugely influential. He wrote a book called The American Political Tradition, in which he did, chapter by chapter, just about all presidents. I think he had Henry Clay in there, because he was the guy who three times almost became president, and people certainly thought he would be there. There may have been a couple of other differences, but essentially I was doing this, the same people he did in the choice, and some of them obvious: Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, well, I mean, Woodrow Wilson, backing up a moment historically. So essentially this was kind of a response to Hofstadter in lots of ways, but that may be a matter for esoteric academic interest. The other question is basically these folks just interested me. I found them really interesting human beings and trying to understand where they were coming from. And then I, for this expansion of about 50% of the original book and revision and so forth, I added Harry Truman just because he was a guy who interested me and I think has a lot to say about character for our current situation, and then extended it to include Newt Gingrich and of course Trump and Biden. Ida B. Wells, a great 19th century journalist who hasn't gotten the attention she deserves, added a chapter on the whole situation with Native Americans and the way I originally got interested in this in terms of Andrew Jackson and his policy, but then every president from Washington through Van Buren, when the Trail of Tears actually occurred just after Andrew Jackson's time, had to deal with this, and they all basically came up with the same solution, namely we need segregation, we need geographic segregation, so move the Native Americans west of the Mississippi. And I was interested in that in terms of just the integrationist impulse, which I think is right in American history, and certainly as a Christian, the race is not a big deal, although in life it often becomes that way. So really, I don't have a hugely rational explanation for every choice. It's just people that originally responding to Hofstadter, and then people who interested me, like Harry Truman.
Yeah, I wanted to pause for a minute on the Trail of Tears. I was raised in Georgia, Marvin, and live here in North Carolina now, which is, you know, Cherokee Indian country, and in both cases. So I was very aware of the Trail of Tears from the time I was a very small boy. It was part of, you know, it was just in the air, so to speak. But it seems to me that that's not so much the case In the popular imagination, that you know, that most Americans, if you ask them, you know, to give a quick summary of American history, you know, it'd be the founding fathers, the founding period. There would be the Civil War, you know, World War II, you know, and today kind of thing, obviously a lot gets skipped over, and maybe could get filled in by people more or less learned in American history. But the Trail of Tears is something that is largely overlooked. I would say, though, maybe until recently. Naomi Schaefer Riley has written a book on the Trail of Tears. Now, I was actually a little bit surprised by the amount of ink you spilled on the Trail of Tears in this book, covering, you know, that basically covered, as you say, several different administrations and leaders, you know, are you making a case in some ways for the elevation of the Trail of Tears as being a more significant part of American history than it has played in the past?
Yeah, I think so, because it's it reveals a lot about our country and the battle between segregation and integration. Reveals a lot about the various presidents, and also reveals a lot about a process like that. It was forcing people to leave their homes was a bad thing under any circumstances. Forcing people under the guise that, well, we wanted to make sure they could still have a good environment for hunting. Whereas a whole lot of them, especially in the Cherokees, had become farmers. They had settled down. They had built churches, so they were culturally adapting, and there was a growing Christian influence. So that's a tragedy that Christian influence in some ways did not become what it otherwise would have become. That the church was tarred with complicity in this, it could have been very different. There's also just Jackson gets blamed for it a lot, and deservedly so to a certain extent. But again, it was every president, and probably Thomas Jefferson was the in some ways the most vicious of all in terms of racial bigotry. Jackson is just an interesting guy in that he adopted a Native American child whose parents had died, his father killed in one of Jackson's military expeditions. So is a complicated guy. Let me just say one other thing about Jackson, since he's the one, there are these polls always of presidents and who's the greatest president, things like that. And Jackson has really fallen off the top 10 and fallen way down, I think largely because of the Trail of Tears. So there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of reason to dislike things that Jackson did, but he's also very moving in some ways. His wife died just before his inauguration as president in 1829, and one of his secretaries, a male secretary, wrote later on about him knocking on Jackson's bedroom door in the White House when there were some papers that Jackson had to look with, and he peers in, and there's Jackson doing what he had done with his wife, reading in the evening, I think it was three chapters of the Bible, and he had his wife's picture propped up there on the desk as he's reading the Bible with her. So, you know, that gets to me emotionally.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in fact, since you mentioned Jackson and sort of the complicated nature of his character, one of the things that I appreciate about this book, Marvin, is that you don't shy away from the complexity of all of these characters. I mean, there would be a tendency, I think, in writing a book like this, and I want you to talk about this, whether you felt this tendency or whether I'm maybe manufacturing it, there would be a tendency to say there are good guys and there are bad guys. This guy is a good guy. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, right? I mean, these are good guys. These are men of character. Their character is the reason they were great leaders. End of story. And bad guys, bad characters were bad leaders. But it's a much more nuanced picture that you paint, which, again, I appreciate. But I am wondering how you're given that complexity, given that nuance, which I think, Marvin Olasky, the journalist, Marvin Olasky, the realist, Marvin Olasky, who is concerned with objective truth, needs to be honest about and portray those realities with integrity. But it does make it hard to draw lessons whenever the picture is a little gray. The images don't come in as sharp a focus, do they?
No, it is complex. And what I tried to do in this book and in my history writing generally, I try to do more showing than telling, as in journalism. So I deliberately wanted to examine the complexity of some of these characters and not come up with a simple good bad type thing, because there were some of these people I really like, some I came to dislike, but they're all complex individuals. And let me mention one other thing in terms of your original question about what I was trying to do with this, why this expanded edition rather than the original. I think in the original I didn't, and this is not just the book, but the way I thought about things, I probably did not take race enough into account, and those types of questions. So I wanted to go back and look at how some of these leaders thought about race and responded to questions. I got involved last night in a discussion about at universities and corporations, the whole push towards diversity, which is, I think, a good thing. I mean, certainly, as Christians, we it's good. We should have diverse churches, and we expect heaven to be diverse. So I didn't take into account enough the racial pressures. And some way, as conservatives, we tend to look at pressures for all the diversity officers at universities and in corporations and so forth, and react against that. But it struck me that, in a sense, when we look at that and we see this as a problem as it is, we should keep in mind what referees in football and basketball learn. Namely, they often see, calling someone for a foul, they often see the second foul. They may miss the first foul and then just penalize people for their action. And then they deserve to be penalized, but let's not forget the first foul. You know, the first foul was a lot of racism. Both in relation to Native Americans, in relation to Blacks and so forth. A lot of racism. And so that's the first foul. And then there's a second foul when you start creating certain quotas and so forth. But and we should criticize that, but we should remember the first foul.
Yeah, another challenge that I'd like for you to talk a little about, Marvin, that you, I think, faced perhaps uniquely in the last section of the book, which was mostly new, the postmodern America section, in which you talk about Bill Clinton, Newt Gingrich, Donald Trump, Joe Biden. That's a section where you've got some personal history. I'm wondering if you could talk about how you navigated that. I know, for example, that when you were editing World during the George W. Bush administration, because you had worked with George W. Bush, you recused yourself from editing any of the stories that were written by World Reporters. You had other editors work on those stories. And that was sort of the firewall that you built between yourself and the editorial process at World. I'm wondering if some of that thinking went into the way you wrote this book. So, for example, I know you know Newt Gingrich. You've had you've had relationships with Newt Gingrich. I know you, as I've already mentioned, you knew George W. Bush, and you intentionally left him out of this book for the most part. So, can you say more about putting together that last section of the book and your thought process in doing so?
Yeah. First of all, I owe Newt a lot personally. I was helpful to him in certain ways, but he was certainly helpful to me. I wrote a book called The Tragedy of American Compassion, and he read it just before he became Speaker of the House in 1995. And so in his inaugural speech. And then he just kept all that year and the following year, he kept just talking about it a lot and praising the book and, you know, assigning it as reading for all the new Republican members of Congress. And because of that, I had a really interesting year and a half commuting back and forth from Austin to Washington and meeting the various political characters. So that in terms of just publicizing the book and then introducing me to this particular type of life that I enjoyed that for a year and a half. I was glad when it was over, but I'm glad to have had that. So I owe Newt that. At the same time, back in, I think, 2007, we had a cover story in World basically saying, Newt, don't run. He was thinking for running for president then. He did 4 years, 4 years later, just because he was very good in certain ways and helpful in certain ways as a bomb thrower. He was also destructive in certain ways as a bomb thrower. And I think particularly since I had met his second wife and so forth, I don't think he acted entirely honorably in that situation. So in terms of character, I was concerned there, but at the same time, a very bright guy. I think he did some useful things as well as some destructive things. But I had to, as editor, as we're thinking about politics, I was involved in that cover and wrote, you know, Newt, don't run, and did some examination, talking with a lot of people about who Newt Gingrich really was and the pluses and the minuses. So, yeah, that was a hard thing because I was both grateful and also standoffish and critical at the same time. Yeah, and I deliberately did not have a chapter on George W. Bush because, I was never. This is really weird. Just one aside here. I mean, I met with him a few times. We had a good informal relationship. I was never employed by him or part of his administration, either as governor or president. But because in 1999, the campaign. When there were reporters who wanted from New York or other papers who wanted to get a sense of who Bush is and dealing with him, the campaign was saying, "We'll talk to Marvin." And so I met with a lot of these reporters, which again was fun and interesting to do. But I didn't really want to be writing about him. Here's the funny part about it: I kept telling reporters that, no, I was not personally close to George W. Bush. I wasn't part of the administration. And the more I said that, the more they thought I must really be involved. And so there were headlines in various publications that I was the ear whisperer. That was one thing in European journalists picked up on this and they're not really understanding American politics. I was the ear whisperer or I was his closest soulmate. These were some things in these papers, all of which was ludicrous. But insofar as I did know the guy, I mean, critical of some of the things he did during his administration, but I still liked and still liked the guy. I really didn't want to write a chapter on that.
Marvin, I don't want to go down this sidetrack because, once again, you've written books about this topic on the journalism and sort of some of the both the importance of journalism, but also some of the pathologies that we see in journalism today. But I do wonder in your examination of leadership if you could say maybe just a word or two about the role that contemporary journalism played in the myth-building process for some of these leaders, we know them, we know George Washington, we know Abraham Lincoln, or at least we think we do. But in reality, what we know is the myth. It really takes an examination of the kind that you have created here before we really know the person.
Yeah, the way the press reacts at different periods is just interesting to contemplate. With Franklin Roosevelt, who of course was in a wheelchair much of the time, photographers never took pictures of him in the wheelchair, and a lot of Americans didn't. And again, this I think was fine. I mean, there was no reason to make a big deal of that, since he was very heroic and brave in overcoming a lot of that physical disability from polio. But a lot of Americans were actually very surprised to find out that he did spend most of his time in a wheelchair. They didn't know. And should there have been something about it? Governor Abbott here in Texas is also in a wheelchair because he was running in Houston and a tree fell on him. And so I spent one day when he was first running for governor, just going around with him, flying around in his little plane. And I was very impressed that, for example, going up the steps in these little plane, he didn't want people to carry him. I mean, he just managed to, you know, he swung himself off the wheelchair. He kind of went backwards up the steps, pulling himself up by strong arms, and then swung into the seat in the airplane. I mean, that was pretty impressive that he did that. And that's part of his character, developing it. So that's one example. John F. Kennedy was incredibly adulterous, not just a little, but a lot. And the reporters knew that, and they didn't report this. And that's something, again, a very magnificent guy in some ways, deeply flawed in other ways. And the American voters deserve to know that about his character. They didn't. Reporters covered up for him. And then, of course, recently there's a whole lot of other stuff going on with Bill Clinton and, of course, Donald Trump and et cetera.
Yeah, and forgive me for interrupting, Marvin, but I think that was sort of my key question here is that, I mean, do the American people deserve to know this? And it sounds like you're coming down on the side of yes, that if you are in a position of high leadership in this country, that, you know, part of maybe it's not a, you know, an ideal situation for you and your family personally, but if you aspire to that office, if you attain that office, then you do give up certain rights and privileges of privacy. I think about even Roosevelt, for example, that that in many ways his behavior was heroic, overcoming polio and operating at a very high level despite physical limitations as, you know, president during World War II. On the other hand, Roosevelt's physical limitations and his ultimate death probably played a fairly significant role in Yalta and Potsdam. And, you know, that's also a part of his legacy as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you said, well, we don't really know about these people. We just know about their public image. In some ways, we historians can learn more about these people. I mean, when they have personal diaries and papers, and when other people who knew them intimately wrote about them. So in a way, historians are more able to look at this if you do a conscientious job than some of the journalists of the time. Maybe. Just one other thought here, and I appreciate I'm sort of a free range chicken at this point. Rather, I can muse about this a little bit. If I tried to simplify, and again, I didn't do this in the book because I wanted to show not tell. But you're asking if I wanted to tell something, I'd say that there are some presidents who are just really egotist. You have to have some ego to become president. But there are some who are just what's in it for me, and that's one type of individual. And I'd say that's a very worrisome situation when you have someone like that. Then you go to another stage. There's what's in it for my party or my faction or whatever. And in some ways, that's better than the just totally selfish egotism, because you are thinking about others. But still, I would hope there's a third stage, and maybe this is asking too much, rather than just thinking about yourself or just thinking about your particular faction, you actually think about, well, the country and the world. And this is why this new expanded edition has the title Moral Vision. I mean, do you actually have a moral vision, or are you just egotistic, or are you just tribalistic, or do you actually have a moral vision that goes beyond individual, your own ego and your own tribe, and tries to think about what's good for the country and the world? And then, of course, you get to the question, well, what is that moral vision? And I would hope that in some ways it's biblically informed. I think George W. Bush had that. Again, I'm not, and there were some big problems, but nevertheless, he had that, and I'm impressed by that. He also had, I think, good personal character. I mean, once he stopped drinking, his life changed. He was always faithful to his wife. He was a good father. All those types of personal things, which count. So, and then you look at other presidents or other candidates or other ex-presidents, and you see very different types of character.
Well, Marvin, we could go on all day. I know I certainly could. I found the book fascinating, and I'd read the earlier book, so there was so much new material here that I just really enjoyed and appreciated a great deal. But we're gonna have to land this airplane and kind of bring this to a close. And I just think there are a lot of great lessons here for people involved in church ministry and ministry leadership, you don't have to be president of the United States. You know, a city councilman or a county commissioner or an elder in your church could benefit from this book. So, Marvin, thanks for writing it. Thanks for sharing it with the world, and thanks for being on the program today.
Good. Thanks for indulging me.
Thanks for listening in on today's conversation with Dr. Marvin Olasky. His new book is Moral Vision, Leadership from George Washington to Joe Biden. The producers for today's program are Rich Rossell and Jeff McIntosh. We get database technical and editorial support from Christina Darnell, Casey Suddeth, Stephen DeBerry, and Kim Roberts. I'm your host, Warren Smith, and I'll be back on Friday with my colleague, Natasha Cowden, with our regular roundup of the week's news. Until then, may God bless you.